the Middletown podcast. I'm Kat Hughes, I'm a research officer at Middletown, and I'm also autistic. In this episode, I chat to Sharon and Kayla McCarthy. Sharon is an academic, lecturer, presenter, trainer, multidisciplined, and Kayla is a speech and language therapist. They're both autistic, and they happen to be mother and son. Along with their colleague, Dr. Michaela Connolly, they've co-written a book, Making Space for Autism, which focuses on how we can adapt different elements of the environment to make them more equitable and improve well-being for autistic people. I started by asking Kaylin how he became a speech and language therapist with a neurodiversity-informed approach.
Okay, so I suppose there's two parts to that. The first is, I suppose, why I wanted to go into SLT, and the second is why then I kind of zeroed in, shall we say, on neurodiversity and on autism specifically. So from the perspective of speech and language therapy, I have been kind of in and out of different therapeutic situations since I was very young. I would be dyspraxic, and later on I would also have been identified as autistic. So I'm very familiar with that kind of really awkward sit down with a big scary person in a room and kind of not sure if they're nice or if they're... So I suppose I always knew that there was... That was a thing that I suppose I love doing in terms of working with kids, and in terms of that bit of engagement. I'm very good at kind of making a fool of myself and getting out on the floor, all that lovely stuff. But I suppose when I was looking at kind of what to go into after school, I really wanted to focus on something that I thought I could make a really big difference in. And that experience I thought could be really helpful. And thankfully, I was right. And I also actually, I grew up in a neurodiverse household. So there's lots of kiddos, lots of different complex needs, and lots of different things that they find annoying and don't. And it's a lovely chaos, but also something that kind of made me really want to be in a position where I could make a positive difference and impact positively on the lives of kiddos who would be in a similar situation. And then I have that kind of personal background in terms of neurodiversity, but it was actually when I started working properly and when I got out into the field and I started working with kids in different clinics that it really clicked with me, because I suppose I knew that I liked working with children. I tried, like, I did my transition year work placement in like a school, same as everybody type thing. But my other one was in the old Southleigh Autism Services. So I think that when I started realizing that, okay, I really like doing my job, and I really especially like doing my job when I'm doing that with somebody who communicates a little bit differently, or when I get feedback from a kiddo saying that, oh my God, you know, like talking to their parents as they're walking out going, you know, he was talking to me, like I really want people to talk to me. And the more I started hearing that stuff, and the more that I realized how important it was as I kind of stepped into my own autistic identity, that the clinical therapies are more directly kind of integrated, or the autistic voice, I suppose, is more directly integrated into the clinical therapies, that it just kind of all fell into place. And like, since I found out that that was what I wanted to do, I haven't looked back since. It's been so wonderful.
Amazing. And I can't imagine the difference it would make as someone who's been through those therapies as well, to immediately feel recognized and to know that the person sitting across from you really does understand your perspective. I can't imagine, like, from day one, the difference that must make. That's lovely. And then Sharon, your work kind of across disciplines is very neuroaffirmative. What was your journey to that approach?
I suppose for me, Kat, as a mom, first and foremost, many, many moons ago, I would have stepped into a space, I would have been a childcare professional. And in that role, I would have stepped into a space where it was all about empowering the child and allowing the child to be their authentic selves and so on and so forth. That kind of refusal to label a child either positively or negatively, not label them as naughty in inverted commas or bold in inverted commas, and instead recognize that all of these kind of experiences and things that children bring to the table are actually them honouring their voices a lot of the time. So I suppose that was the very, very, very foundational piece. And I suppose that sat That sat very strongly with me. First of all, as a parent, really wanted to step into a space where I could empower my children to be themselves and where I could empower my children to recognize the importance of their own voice. But I suppose as they started school, as they navigated all of these kind of different social constructed spaces, and suddenly it became very apparent that that there was a pressure on them to behave and to be a very particular way, to comply, to engage with things very specifically and very neurotypically. Now I know to be the truth. I suppose so. There was always that kind of questioning piece. I suppose as an autistic person myself, I would have experienced that expectation for compliance without ever realizing that that's what the expectation was. And I suppose that did result for me in like a more negative inner narrative, that kind of inner narrative, that kind of dialect and so on. It did also result in me kind of feeling more insecure and so on. I didn't want that to be the case for my young people. And I suppose as I said, stepped into the role from an academic standpoint and from a professional standpoint, then maybe about 10 or 12 years ago, it just became more and more obvious that there's a really explicit reason for why so many of us navigate those kind of mental well-being challenges and those kind of difficulties with authenticity and feeling the need to mask and so on. And I suppose it was from there that this want to change and this want to create a space where people can step into themselves truly grew. I suppose I'm very mindful, Kat, that it's essential that our kids, our young people, our autistic adults, as parents, as professionals, as whatever, like if from whatever space we come from, I think I'm so mindful of the fact that there is that societal pressure altogether, and that it's really important that now is the time that there's a shift from that kind of expectation for conformity and sameness to an acceptance and an appreciation of uniqueness and of diversity and of kind of shifting the space so that all brains, all abilities, all strengths, all experiences are accepted and appreciated just as they are. And I suppose recognizing that uniqueness is an absolute necessity almost for societal growth. I suppose it's really, really important to me from a value standpoint that everybody is afforded the opportunity to be themselves without judgment, and everybody is afforded the opportunity to be able to express themselves as they grow. I suppose that's across all aspects, all areas, from education to workplace to parenting to family to relationships to whatever. And I suppose we have to focus on it in every aspect. And I suppose it is that kind of coming in at the first point and hitting these young people really, really with that real empowering information and so on, and building on it from there, I suppose. So I know I slot into a couple of different areas from a mentoring standpoint to an education standpoint to a kind of a family support person and an advocate and so on and so forth. But it doesn't matter what role I step into. What matters is that these young people and these adults are afforded that absolute opportunity to be themselves.
That's gorgeous. And that expression that you use, stepping into themselves, is so beautiful because there's so much agency. They're doing it themselves, but they're allowed to thrive in the way that they are and the way that suits them best. So that's beautiful. I love it. So I know that your work for both of you focuses a lot on environment. And I think people think a lot of sort of physical environment when we say environment. So what do you mean when you say environment?
So I might start, Kayle, and I'll leave you join in if that's okay.
No, that's fair enough.
For me specifically, I think about when I think about the environment immediately, the very first aspect that comes to mind is that physical space, considering universal design, considering standardized widths of 1,000 millimeters for a doorway in order to ensure accessibility for a wheelchair user, for example, I suppose. And that makes huge amounts of sense. But the reality is that for me, at least, I kind of think about when I think about the environment, I really think about the autistic person's experience within that space. And the reality is that some autistic people absolutely do navigate physical disability and are wheelchair users and so on. But actually, the more pressing issues that many autistic people face are those kind of sensory issues, are those communicative issues, are those social issues, and so on. And I suppose when we started on this project, it felt very important to ensure that people understood every component part of the environment. So the environment isn't just physical. The environment is absolutely physical, but within that physical space, you have all of those additional components. You do have the emotional component, the social component, the sensory component, and so on. And I suppose in order to best facilitate the autistic person's experience, it's necessary to meet them where they're at in all of those areas. It's necessary to facilitate their needs and to create accessibility in every single part of that space. So I suppose when we think about the pressure that somebody might feel from a sensory standpoint, for example, it's all well and good to have a door 1,000 millimetres wide. But if the person can't access the space because the light is too bright or because the acoustics are too vibrational, they're experiencing them at that kind of almost physiological level, then it's not helpful. The widened door, while helpful and absolutely should be, should always be standardized for those individuals who are wheelchair users. But that doorway isn't helpful in that moment for the autistic person. I suppose this isn't just about creating a physical space of safety. This is absolutely about creating accessibility, but a kind of an equity and accessibility almost. So allowing for every individual to access a space and to utilize it in the way that they need to, rather than again being expected to navigate a space in a very specific way. So it is about that kind of individual experience, that individual processing of a space, and ensuring that that individual, that person, stays central to how they experience that space. I suppose it can be very difficult for an autistic person to navigate, as I'm sure Caelan will agree, to navigate different spaces when there is that kind of demand and that expectation and so on. But wouldn't it be wonderful if there were all of these these spaces where people didn't have the pressure to navigate those expectations, those experiences, those negatively impactful experiences? Wouldn't it be wonderful if they instead could step into a space and kind of go, okay, actually, I feel safe here. I feel comfortable here. I feel seen here, and I don't feel under pressure here. I can be here and I can feel good whilst I'm here. So I suppose it was that piece that really spurred that kind of the idea that we needed to start looking at the environment and breaking it down. I suppose it's really important, though, at the same time, just before Caelan comes in to share, I suppose it's important to recognise Dr. Luke Bearden, Sheffield Hallam University. I have no doubt that many of your listeners and yourself included, Kat, would have heard of him. I have huge admiration for Luke. I would consider him quite a good friend at this point. And I suppose considering his golden equation, that autism plus environment equals outcome, that in and of itself is so simplistic, but yet so profound. Why not create a space where autism plus positive experience equals positive outcome? So I suppose it was that piece too. I do have to recognize, I suppose, and to take note of the fact that Luke's golden equation definitely influenced and created that kind of almost like that momentum in wanting to change things up for autistic people when I was having different conversations with him as well. And I know, I've no doubt that Caelan and Michaela, the other author of our book, would agree with that as well. But I do think, if nothing else, if somebody wants to take away from today, autism plus environment equals outcome, that's a hugely simplistic but profound statement that can be applied to every single space that you step into.
No, I'd absolutely agree with that, I suppose. And I think you've kind of hit the nail on the head for a lot of it. Like from my perspective, just to even kind of briefly add on, I think that, like, I have been the person, again, I know I keep kind of coming back to that personal piece, but like I've been the person who hasn't been able to enjoy a party in the same way as a friend of mine, or who's been out. I met a friend for a few drinks about a year ago now, and I hadn't seen her for about 3 years, and I managed to stay out there for half an hour because the environment was so overwhelming. And it wasn't just, as Sharon is saying, that physical component. It was the fact that it was too loud, it was too messy, there was everything was sticky, and there was too many people and too many like potential moments where I could be approached to have a conversation, or I could end up bumping up against the wrong person, and like it sapped the ability for me to enjoy that and to be in that space from that night for me. And I know that this is something that, like, I suppose I've been very lucky to have a foundation built for me at home, because this is something that I know that we're talking about now with something that Sharon has been thinking about for 10 years. Like, I remember her sitting down on our couch 10 years ago talking about it. But I think for me, the thing that, like, really hammered home that this is something that, like, that the environment really is lots of different things was when I was sitting down working again with smallies, with a couple of particular kiddos who weren't using words to communicate. And they were instead using lovely hand gestures, and they were leading their mom and their dad in the session hand over hand over to what they wanted. They were stimming, and it was just so lovely and so expressive and so wonderful that this autistic way of communicating was their preferred way of communicating. And it kind of baffled me then, I suppose, that we were looking at the end goal for some of those kiddos being, okay, we're gonna teach them to talk, like, as if we could do that. Whereas when you look at the environment through that kind of lens, that golden equation, that environment plus autistic person as outcome, then you see that actually, no, if you create a communication environment, or if you look at the communication aspect of the environment and allow for that autonomous autistic communication to be central to it, suddenly that autistic person is communicating in a wonderful way. And it's not something that people are looking at and don't really understand. And it's not something that they have to alter in order to be understood and to be expressive and to be funny and to be angry and, like, just to show off who they are and what they want to do. So I do think it's that, like, it's looking at the environment like that multifaceted approach. It also kind of makes it a bit easier because, like, I suppose we've all been in schools, I've noted, we've all had or heard experiences, Mom, I know you have, of people who have, of teachers who have stood at the top of the room and gone, "That's too hard to do that. I don't want to change that. There's too much to do. What are you talking about? I can't do everything." And I think that by breaking the environment down like we have, it turns the workload, in the biggest inverted commas in the world, into something that's more manageable and something that's easier to present. And then kind of looking at how those things intersect and making sure that, okay, so you might have done one thing in the room, you might have made one change, and that's supporting the communication environment, but this other change that we asked you to make, and that really important for a kiddo to be able to access the space, is to do with the sensory environment, and that hasn't been changed. So I just think it's a really subtle reframing, but it does, I think, just add a lot more flexibility to the way that we offer supports and a lot more depth to how we can offer support. So I know I'm kind of going off on a bit of a tangent, but that is kind of, that's where I'm kind of with everything.
Well, I kind of think though too, Caelan, on a very serious note, that it does speak ultimately then to respect for the autistic person's experience, to respecting them, to respecting their experiences, to respect it, to ensuring that their needs are facilitated holistically. That it's not just this, okay, you fit into my box and you do this. It speaks to that absolute, okay, you are perfect just as you are. And let's ensure that you have every opportunity to flourish and to grow. Because when you think about that educational space and so on, and that expectation to have to learn in a very particular way, and being left to fail or being left with this real sense of, I'm not good enough, I'm not valuable enough, I'm not as clever, or I'm not as smart as everybody else in the class. And that's bound to create that real feeling of disharmony and discombobulation for a young person or for a young student or a mature student or whomever the case may be. So I suppose it does. It absolutely actually comes down, not just to, like, it comes down to two things. It comes down to accessibility and that kind of holistic accessibility. And then it also comes down to respect of the person for exactly who they are. Nothing more and nothing less at the end of the day. And that kind of reframing of our understanding of the environment absolutely facilitates the creation of a space that is both accessible and respectful of the autistic person's experience.
I couldn't agree more.
Gorgeous. And then you've packaged up that ethos into an incredibly practical and user-friendly but really informative book. Making Space for Autism. So what were you sort of hoping you would achieve by putting the book together?
Well, I suppose I can start if you'd like. Again, I was kind of lucky enough in some ways to be carted on a little bit because, like, as I say, this is something that I am very passionate about, but very broadly passionate about, whereas Sharon has had this, the bones of this specific thing in her head for as long as I've been, like, around, type thing. So I think that when we were looking at what the benefits of, like, putting this forward into a book would be, it's about taking that passion and it's about taking that idea and that framework that we have there that takes pressure off of the autistic person and sharing it and disseminating it and, like, creating, as you said, Kat, an accessible way for people to kind of step by step go through the process of creating holistically comfortable, accessible spaces for autistic young people and actually autistic people of any age. Because I suppose I'm used to talking about kiddos, but actually, the stuff in here, there's strategies that, while we were kind of looking at them, there are things that I've started doing in my day-to-day life. I have my schedules up and I have my timers and all that stuff. So it's just, it was the idea of kind of framing things in a way that they hadn't really been framed before and presenting that to people to give them the option of going about things in that way. I don't know, Sharon, if you have something that you'd like to kind of throw in there as well.
So I suppose ultimately for me, it was about taking the responsibility from the autistic person to conform and to comply and to step into a space and instead allow for them to exist in a space without pressure and allow for them to exist in a space where there was that kind of, there was the permission to kind of create who they are and step into their own strengths and their own areas of kind of ability and so on. And I suppose in doing so as well, in creating those accessible spaces, it ultimately would, in my opinion at least, lead to that kind of broader societal acceptance of the autistic experience. So imagine a space where a little person or an autistic adult or an autistic teen or whomever could stim freely without feeling under pressure, without feeling judged. I suppose we were as a family recently at a local or at an Irish, shall we say, amusement park. And we have a gorgeous 7-year-old in this house who started to feel quite dysregulated, who could explain and use his words to communicate that he was starting to feel quite dysregulated. And yet when I asked him, like, does he want to go for a stim? Will we do a little bit of a stim or whatever? And he became completely uncomfortable, saying, but I can't because people might think I'm weird, in inverted commas, around here, because people don't know me. People don't understand me, Mama. So I suppose imagine the power that could be created within a space where any aged person could step in and go, yeah, I feel like I need to have a bit of a stim. I'm just going to engage with it. I don't have to hide who I am. Wouldn't it be wonderful to create a space where people wouldn't feel under as much pressure to mask all of the time, where they wouldn't lose their kind of identity, and where instead they would be empowered to to just be again themselves, authentically speaking. I think that if for no other reason, the idea of kind of universal design and environmentally from an autistic perspective, I think if for no other reason, that idea, it provides that kind of foundation for fairness, for fundamental kind of well-being. It provides the opportunity to learn how to self-advocate, to learn how important your voice is, to learn how important what you bring to the table is. And absolutely, we all have moments where we feel overwhelmed and we feel less than or whatever the case may be. But again, I come back to the fact that the stats speak to autistic people's experience being so much more prevalent in that area than a non-autistic person's experience, for example. Wouldn't it be wonderful, again, just to come back to that accessibility, equality, equity? Wouldn't it be wonderful if a space was equitable, whereby people who are autistic or otherwise neurodivergent and people who are of that kind of majority group, that neurotypical group, wouldn't it be wonderful if experiences matched? So I suppose that would have been the reason, my reason for kind of thinking about this and for kind of wanting to bring that to the fore.
Okay. And what advice would you give to someone who wants to better understand their autistic students in relation to their environments that they're experiencing?
So for me, I suppose, first of all, equality doesn't equal equity. So this idea that every child should get the same thing and every child should have a sit and move cushion and every child should be able to sit at the front of the room and so on and so forth, that doesn't work. It is about equity. It is about ensuring, and actually going beyond that, it is about creating a space of justice whereby every child's needs are met, autistic or otherwise, to ensure that every child is afforded the opportunity to flourish and to become their best selves. I suppose, I think from an education standpoint, it is absolutely essential that a child is listened to. But not only are they listened to, that their voice is actively included in any decision that is made about around them. So not just that listening, but hearing and including as well. I think that it's essential that our kids, that all children actually, not just autistic children, that every child is given that kind of the opportunity to recognize their strengths, and that they see that other people recognize their strengths, because there is that validation and that interpersonal piece as well, that kind of important piece like that. I think that it's really, really, really important too, and no disrespect, as an educator myself, I think that there's three other things, and then I leave Caelan come in. So I suppose it's really important to say that recognizing educators, as an educator myself, I know it's a little bit hard to kind of swallow it sometimes, but actually the responsibility lies with you as the educator to create a space where people, where children, where young people, where adults' strengths can shine. It is down to you as the person who is taking command of that room to ensure the sensory safety of somebody, the physical safety of somebody, that social safety, and so on and so forth. I think that it is really important for educators to shift their perspective from one of neurotypicality, so one where everybody has to be the same, to one where all neurotype needs are considered. So not just expecting somebody to behave in the same way that everybody else does, but instead consider individual needs. It takes a tiny bit more work, but it's so much more rewarding in the long term. And I suppose just to say too that any of these things that we're talking about, they're not just applicable to autistic children or to ADHD kiddos or whatever. They are applicable, they are helpful, and they are useful for every single child, for every single teenager, for every single adult, regardless of neurotype. And I suppose the other thing, which is very, very practical, actually, on a very serious note, is when you think about education, I suppose I think we can all agree on screen that the reality is that one of the key pieces to creating those first feelings of safety is predictability. Let's create those spaces where things are concrete, where things are predictable, where we allow for that kind of natural lowering of anxiety, where we allow for young people to be able to actually take in what is being shared, right, where they can actually act actively learn rather than expecting them to wade through the white noise that they have to navigate all of the time and sometimes miss out on all of this important information. It is when we kind of lay that absolute and safe foundation that children will absolutely then start to step into this, their kind of space as academic beings. I suppose an example, Kat, very seriously would be like myself. I did Leaving Cert and I did Junior Cert as part of the Irish education system and so on. And I just about managed. I spent 10 years back in college. And for 10 years, because I was interested in the area that I studied, I maintained first class honours. And I was top in whatever classes a couple of times and so on. So therein lies and therein speaks to when the person's learning style is facilitated correctly and is actually kept central to everything, then the person actually has the opportunity to showcase what they're genuinely made of rather than what they're trying to scramble towards.
Are there some tips or tools that you would love people to start implementing tomorrow in relation to sort of improving the environment for autistic people?
I mean, so this, in terms of the most important piece of advice that I could give anybody, I suppose, is remember when to listen. Because I know as well as anybody else how hard it is sometimes to relinquish control and to allow somebody else who you might not think knows what's best have the floor and dictate how things are run. Say it happens in sessions all the time, but the thing about that is when I meet a kid, I've met them for an hour or I've met them for a set of six sessions. I know them for that long. Even their mom and dad know them 18 hours a day, say, and then they're kind of watching them to make sure they're not like passing out while they're sleeping. But that person, that young person knows who they are and knows themselves better than anybody else in the world. So I think when I'm talking to parents, when I'm talking to educators, when I'm talking to other therapists and other clinicians, the first thing is let that little autistic person have a voice. Or let any autistic person have a voice. Again, I'm talking about the kids. But like, let them know that their opinion matters, that they have a say, that they're going to be included in discussions, that they're going to be allowed to input into decisions that concern them from whatever point you meet them, because doing that creates trust and doing that actually allows you to become more familiar with what they need from you. And they like, that allows you then to tailor their experience. So again, talking about that equity, it lets you know what kids need at schedule on the wall, what kids can have a break card or need to put up a hand signal because they feel uncomfortable. It's about being able to figure out what their safe space is, because identifying a safe space, a safe person, is a really important thing for anybody to have in a space. It gives you that knowledge. It gives you those tools. So it baffles me why somebody wouldn't use it. And sorry, Jared, I don't know if you want to kind of jump in as well.
I suppose literally just two things to add to what you said, Caelan, quite literally, is provide every autistic person, young or old, that you know with the opportunity to create and to employ escape plans. Nobody wants to be stuck in a space where they don't feel safe. So let's make sure that they have the opportunity to remove themselves, and let's create an environment where the person actually feels safe to articulate that. And the other piece, I suppose, from a regulation standpoint and from a well-being standpoint, is stimming. We've got to remember how important stimming is to the autistic person. So it is essential that no matter where and what environment a person finds themselves in, that they have the opportunity to stim, because stimming is what allows for a person to manage, to regulate themselves, to process, to engage with emotions and so on and so forth. There has to be an acceptance of stimming. And if you've got a young person who is uncomfortable, or if you've got an adult who is young, who is uncomfortable with stimming in public, create a safe space for them to do so. label it explicitly, create every opportunity for the person to kind of mind themselves and to look after themselves. This is a fundamental and foundational well-being piece.
Hugely important. Absolutely. I've been nodding vigorously so much that I'm aware of my chair squeaking every time I nod. I'm agreeing so much for what you guys are saying. Thank you so, so much for chatting to me. I honestly could talk to you for another couple of hours. It's really fascinating, but I really appreciate talking to you. Thank you so much.
Thanks a million. Thanks for the opportunity.
It's fabulous.
Absolutely. And I suppose just to say, we so appreciate the opportunity to share. Just to acknowledge that Dr. Michaela Connolly, our colleague, isn't here today because her voice is equally important in all this. And I kind of think that merging of experiences was really important in bringing kind of dual perspectives and so on to the table. And just to say that, I suppose, to recognize too that everybody is doing their best as well at the same time. So it's really important. Don't beat yourself up. If you get something wrong, it is okay. It is about the kind of moving forward and always knowing that things don't have to stay stagnant, that we can move things forward and change things up. And we only know something when we know them. And once we come from a space of love initially, everything after that is great. Everything after that is positive. So I suppose starting with the environment and then allowing for things to flourish after that would be amazing.
Thanks so much for listening to the podcast. If you want to know more about Middletown, you can find us on Twitter @Autism Centre or on Facebook or Instagram @Middletown Centre for Autism.